Blog Talk Radio.
I'd like to welcome everyone to John Talk Radio tonight. This is our June 18, 2016 show. My special guest is John Wolashuk. John is a vocalist, multi-instrumentalist, songwriter, engineer, one of the founding members of Klaatu. John, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me on, John. I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, I appreciate your time. One of the things that I would like to do in this interview is for people to get to know you, and I think one of the important things in an interview, I always tell this story, and I think it's kind of relevant. There were musicians that I really didn't know much of, and I would hear their music, and I really wouldn't appreciate their music. One of them that I always talk about, John, is Meat Loaf. I knew he was a popular musician. I heard his music. I just wasn't really into it. And one time I was walking the dog, and I listened to an interview of him. And I got a totally, completely different perspective and respect for the man after the interview, because I was thinking, wow, I really didn't know where he was coming from. So one of the things I love to do in these interviews that I've been doing, you know, for around 8 years is for people to get to know who John Wolashuk is and to understand, you know, I know that by listening to the music, as we started with Dr. Marvelo, and the different songs that you've written are amazing, but we want to just kind of peel it back a little bit and get to know you as a person and how you got involved in music. And if you could, John, just walk us through, like, you know, how you, where you grew up and how, you know, you embraced music as a young person, and maybe some of the influences, or, you know, how you got started in music.
Well, I was born and raised in Toronto. I've lived here all my life. And, you know, when I was 13, I started getting interested in the music on the radio. When the Beatles came over in early 64 to the United States, which is the beginning of the British invasion, you know, I was pretty well already into listening to radio quite seriously at that point. But they really, you know, raised the ante quite a bit over what it had been, and they definitely revolutionized the scene. So I sort of got more and more interested as time went on. And then when the Sgt. Pepper album came out, that was really sealed the deal for me. I just really wanted to, it was that album really that I think incentivized me to want to learn how to write music, even though at the time I didn't know anything about it. So, you know, there was a lot of great music around on radio in the 1960s from both sides of the Atlantic. And so it was really a very rich environment to grow up in musically. And so I just started, you know, trying to learn songs, you know, learn what the chords were. I think I got my first, I borrowed a guitar from a buddy of mine, and he showed me some chords, how to play the guitar, and I sort of took it from there and just started, you know, just learning as many songs as I could. And that sort of evolved into an interest in recording as well. And the first recorder I had was a Philips Continental 420, which is a sound-on-sound four-track machine. And I purchased that in the fall of 1967. And that really got me into the idea, you know, that allowed me to record four-track recordings in my basement of my parents' place.
Wow.
And I think the very first song I recorded was Girl by the Beatles. Of course, I was really rough then. I was just learning. But it went on from there, you know, and I just got more and more interested. And then the next step was to actually try and write something. And I had written a couple of things. I think I wrote maybe one or two things between the ages of 16 and 18. But then I met my songwriting partner, Dino Tomei, I think it was the fall of 1967. And at the time, he had emigrated to Canada from Italy, and his English was virtually none. But we both shared an interest in music, particularly in the Beatles. So, you know, we actually started writing in March of 1969. And then we just continued on, and sort of between 1969 and 1972, I guess, you know, we just kept developing our writing. And I mean, I didn't always co-write with Dino. I wrote quite a few numbers on my own as well. But we did write, for example, Dino co-wrote Sub Rosa Subway with
me. Wow, yep.
And we've remained really good friends over the years. And as far as bands is concerned, none of the bands that I was in prior to Clatoo would be a noteworthy to anybody listening. But the first band I was in, it was the summer of 1966, I was 16, and I bought myself a Hohner organ, one of those little wee dinky ones. The group was named Trax, that's T-R-A-X, and in that band was Terry Draper, who was the drummer.
Oh.
And I actually joined that band. It was a pre-existing band, and I was able to join it because I think their rhythm guitar player was going to quit. And they wanted a keyboard player, so I just had my new Hohner organ, so I filled in and I stuck with them. Then after that, I had a brief, about 2-week experience on another band called Kingdom Show Band, which I really wasn't into because by then I was starting to get seriously into analyzing music and trying to learn how to write and things like that. By then I had a pretty substantial knowledge of chords. Things, you know, some theory. I mean, not theory like long hair theory, but you know, just the nuts and bolts of putting songs together. So I really didn't want to stay in that band. So I quit that band, and I ended up taking the equipment back and getting a refund on it. And that's the funds that I used to buy my Continental 420 Philips tape recorder.
Wow.
And that was probably the most momentous decision I've ever made, was to get that little tape recorder. And it was great. It was absolutely great. It came with a real cheap stereo mic. And a real cheap set of $15 headphones. But I was the only kid in Toronto that had headphones in those days.
That's wild.
And it was great, you know. And we used those Philips tape. Dino ended up buying himself a Philips tape recorder later on, and we used those right up until the Clan 2. In fact, the Sub Rosa Subway, a demo. We did demos of Sub Rosa Subway on the 420. And I still have it, actually, but all the rubber belts have melted into goo. It doesn't really,
well,
you know.
That's great that you have it, though. That's,
yeah,
well,
I wouldn't get rid
yeah.
of it. It may be worth something someday.
yeah, that's
but,
pretty
no,
awesome.
There's quite a strong sentimental attachment to it, so a lot of memories attached to it, let's put it that way.
Right. When did you know that it was just as important to, like, produce and engineer music and to record music as, because I'm sure, John, you mentioned the Beatles and hearing them, you know, for the first time, and how that piqued your interest. And I can't even tell you how many interviews I've had where, you know, that has happened to people. It was like, it was this awakening, you know, that people
yeah.
thought, wow, that's what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing, I think, with the Beatles and with bands as they kind of progressed was there were groups that were fairly shallow. The music was shallow. The productions were shallow, even though the talent was there. But the productions and some of the songs were just amazing. When did you start thinking, John, that really was something you were interested in, that piece of it?
Well, I mean, I didn't have the capability, equipment-wise, to do it until I actually started recording in a studio. But prior to that, you know, even with the Continental 420, I mean, we used to try and do, you know, weird things. Again, we were quite limited. But I think where we really blossomed or sort of grew, matured on that score was after I met Terry Brown, who was the producer of our first three albums.
Right.
I met him in the fall of 1972. I was actually on a job search. I wanted to get a job as an assistant engineer at a studio in Toronto. And, of course, in those days, I think there was only five what you would consider major studios in the whole city. And Terry's studio was called Toronto Sound Studios. And it was the last one on my list. And I nearly never went to it, but I left a phone message and he actually returned my call. I mean, he didn't know me then. I was just a name that out of the blue. And he called me and said I could come in for an appointment. So I went in and I met him and, you know, I was giving him my resume and everything. But during the course of the meeting, I had taken a little folio of lyrics that I have. And he read through them and showed some interest and asked me if I had any demos of them. And I said, well, no, not really, but I could make you some. And he said, well, why don't you go make me some demos and bring them back and let me hear them. So needless to say, I immediately started working on that. I also called up D. Long, who had been in a band with me called Mud Cow. And
right.
Coincidentally, D and I were both working on assembly lines at his father's electronics factory at the time that I canvassed Terry Brown for a job. And so I asked D if he'd like to come along and do some demos, because I knew D's writing already. I'd worked with D for over a year at that point, and I really respected his writing. So I asked him if he wanted to come in with me on this, and he said, sure. So he put his demos together, and I put my demos together, and I think it was somewhere around October or so of 1972, we went to Toronto Sound Studios for an appointment with Terry Brown, and I remember meeting him in what was called the dubbing room at the studio, and he set it up so that we could play our demos on our own machines, but then we would dub them over to his reboxes. And so we did, and much to my surprise, he was totally floored. Even after the first track he heard, he was just grinning from ear to ear and really Because we had been turned down, by the way. We had done live auditions for, oh, I don't know, half a dozen or more record company people as Mudcow, and nobody was interested. So the fact that we had Terry Brown's interest on these demos was really quite a development for us. And he was totally into it, and he just said they're great, and he just wanted to put them in front of his partner, Doug Riley, who was a great producer, arranger, and composer in his own right. He was like the George Martin of Toronto Sound Studios.
Wow.
And so Doug Riley listened to the demos. I wasn't there, but Terry Brown let us know later on that he had heard them and approved, and they wanted to sign us. And it was just me and Dee. And so the very first song we recorded under that arrangement was Heinous of Uranus. And having an opportunity to work in a real studio, and at that time it was 16-track.
Wow. Yeah.
And we'd never worked anything more than 8-track up to that point. And so it was really a big deal. I mean, this was one of the 5 major studios in Toronto, and Terry Brown, of course, had a big resume from when he worked in Britain. And so we were, you know, we were really inspired by the opportunity, and that just sort of grew from there. And our relationship with Terry Brown really evolved, where he became more and more intricately involved in the ideas and everything of our records. You know, he really started treating us as, well, we actually thought of him as a member of the band during the recording of the first album, because for all intents and purposes, he was. And he really did some marvelous things engineering-wise. One notable example would be Little Neutrino. All those sound effects and explosions and everything are really due to Terry Brown's work on using all kinds of echoes and things. He was just phenomenal. So, yeah, and I think that I was always a real fan of psychedelic music. I mean, I really was. And anything psychedelic, I loved. And so I really wanted to try and emulate that kind of music because I just thought it was so cool. And I think the very first time I heard Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields Forever, I was on a bus, and somebody had a little transistor radio, and I remember hearing it thinking, what the hell is that? I mean, it was just so different from anything anybody else was doing. And it was
exactly,
of course, I wasn't even 17 yet. I was just barely 17 yet. And so, you know, it was just way above what I'd been used to hearing from them. It certainly wasn't She Loves You. And that really opened some doors, you know, mentally. You know, I thought, wow, this is great. I mean, of course, at that time, we didn't know what the word psychedelic meant. But the word I would prefer to use is surreal.
Yeah.
That music is of surreal quality.
Exactly. I think it's so interesting because with the Beatles were doing their recording in England, I've talked to different bands about it, and what was happening in San Francisco at that same time with, you know, with Jefferson Airplane and with all these different groups and the experimentation that they were going through and the different sounds that were going on and the Birds and these different groups. And they were even, the Beatles were listening to some of that and thinking, wow, you know, that's interesting. Although it was, they were feeding off of the Beatles. But I think it's really cool, John, how that different musicians and different people like can be influenced by someone. But it's not like a copy of it. It's just like feeding off of it. You heard the music, like you were talking about Sgt. Pepper, which, you know, is going to be 50 years coming up here, which is kind of hard to believe. But and what's incredible to me also, John, is the fact that I haven't heard an album that has impacted the music industry or music in rock music or any type of music since then like that. And what do you think that is all about? I mean, I think that's incredible because it's still like number one on most of the list of rock albums. It was so innovative and so adventurous. I think the word adventurous is something that I like because you talked about meeting Terry Brown and feeding off of that. I think one of the things that was interesting with the Beatles that they were allowed to do that. They were allowed to experiment because a lot of, as you know, through with your experience with the music industry, sometimes that's allowed and sometimes it isn't. And they want to make money, so they want to make sure that what you're producing is going to be popular. What do you think about that? Whereas with you talked about She Loves You and those songs. The Beatles were very popular. The music was right. It was for everybody. Then all of a sudden, things started changing a little bit with Rubber Soul and with Revolver. And it kept going. Like, I always think of the same thing, John, with the Beach Boys. You know, there they were, this great harmony band, kind of like the Four Freshmen. And then Brian started going out into this world that was unexplored to a lot of people. What's your take on that? And I think some of it, you know, is missing today. I think that exploration, that like Lewis and Clark type thing, it's like, okay, I know what's important. I know what's going to pay the bills. I know what's going to make people happy, but I'm not real interested in that. Could you kind of talk about that a little bit, how it, you know, relates with your songwriting?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, the Beach Boys are a good example because I remember hearing Good Vibrations for the first time, and it was quite a departure from what they had been doing. It wasn't Surfer Girl. I love the early Beach Boys, by the way. Don't get me wrong. You know, I used to get together with some high school buddies when I was about 15 or 16, and on Friday nights we'd get together and just bash, you know, with our guitars and stuff. We weren't very good, but, you know, we used to do stuff like Barbara Ann and things like that. And when you look at Good Vibrations and God Only Knows, and even the way they do Swoop John B, even though that's a traditional song, their arrangement of it is phenomenal. And I think that bands in those days were really feeding off each other. I mean, McCartney gives full credit to the Pet Sounds album for what was going down on Revolver, you know?
Yeah, and it's his birthday today, so we have to put that plug in.
Oh, okay.
It's Paul's birthday. Yeah.
You know, but I think that that's really what defined the psychedelic era, I think, was the willingness to experiment. You know, plus I think you'd have to be, you know, honest and admit that I think there was some influence from people, you know, smoking marijuana or whatever drugs they were on. But there is, you know, it's like alcohol was like the drug of like the Hemingways in the 1940s.
Right.
And
exactly.
You know, whereas in the 60s, you know, it was like acid and all this kind of stuff. But it wouldn't have happened if the guys in the beginning didn't have the talent to write great songs in the first place.
Right. It wasn't the reason that the songs were good.
No. It's just that it was an enabler.
Yeah.
It let them, you know, raise their horizons a little bit higher than they would have otherwise. But they were still, you know, the songs were still the product of their great minds. And, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the reason Sgt. Pepper's is so great, and most of the Beatles stuff is so great, but that particular is that it essentially had three geniuses in the band plus Ringo. And Ringo was the genius on the drummer, but he wasn't the genius as a writer. But he's still a great drummer. And then you had George Martin there as well.
Right.
And George Martin was definitely a huge asset and influence on a lot of that stuff, particularly the technical side of things and the arrangements. I mean, if you look at the arrangement that George Martin wrote for Strawberry Fields Forever and also on I'm the Walrus, they're really surreal. And this is a guy that was like a World War II vet, you know.
Yeah.
He was straight up. He had short hair. Probably never smoked a joint in his life.
Yep.
But he, you know, he knew what, you know, psychedelia was all about somehow. And so I think that album is really a confluence of events and talents. That it was just the right album for the right time by the right people. And I think the Beatles were ready to make an album like that. I think that there was a lot of pent up frustration on their part. Up to the end of the touring, because they had no time to do what they really wanted to do. They didn't have enough time to do what they really wanted to do in the studio. And if you look at Rubber Soul, and then you look at Revolver, and then you look at Sgt. Pepper's, on each successive album, they used more and more time to record it. You know, it wasn't like the standard three weeks or whatever that they used to use. And given the luxury of that kind of time, allowed them to actually create in the studio, instead of having to come to the studio with fully composed songs. They might come into the studio with like half idea of a song or whatever, and then work it out collectively. So it was just a confluence of events, I think. My view is that Sgt. Pepper's is the peak of the Beatles. I love Abbey Road. I think it's a great album, and thank God they didn't let It Be their last album. And I think the reason they did Abbey Road was that they didn't want Let It Be to be their last album.
I agree with that.
And they overlooked their differences business wise and otherwise at that point, because they knew that they were breaking up when they did Abbey Road. Absolutely, they knew that that was the last album, and they wanted to put out something that was, you know, justified for their career. They couldn't end their career on a down note, and so they did on an up note. But I think the pinnacle of their career, as far as I'm concerned, is Sgt. Pepper's. And I remember I bought that album when it first came out, and I was sitting for exams that week. I think it was in grade 12, and I didn't get any studying done that day. I just kept playing the album over and over and over. I figured, you know, I'll just put it on once and I'll go study, right? Yeah, right. Not knowing what I was going to hear. Not, you know, because I hadn't heard anything from it yet. I just knew it had a weird album cover, and so I bought it, you know, without hearing it first, and I put it on the turntable, and I was just blown away. From the opening track with that Sgt. Pepper's opening, it's like, yike, what is this? This is so good, you know?
Isn't that awesome? Yeah, well, I think it's a great point because, you know, with the album, and you have it in your hand, and you have the artwork, and I know that Klaatu did so many great things also with your cover art. And I mean, you can get the album, you can look at it, you can start thinking about things. You know, you stimulate people just not to listen. But now I think music is just like, you can listen to so many things, John, but like back then, you know, you had to put some effort in to get an album. Like I had to go all the way in. I had to take a Greyhound bus from my little town into Columbus, Ohio, to go to a department store to, after I'd worked to make the money to buy the album, to buy and to get it in your hand and to read everything on it. I mean, the credits, to look at the whole thing. And I think that's what also with Klaatu, with your albums, you know, you can also see that, you know, you can see that imagination. You can see that music speaks for itself, but you've also got, you know, a lot of things going on there graphically and in the cover art. And I think that's really missing in today. Just not with the music, John, but I think with the whole art thing of music, you know, with the whole nine yards, making that experience of an album.
Yeah, and it's largely, I think, because there's no leader in the music scene the way there used to be in the 60s and early 70s. And, you know, in order to get played back in the 60s and 70s, I mean, you had to be good. Your music had to be good. It had to be memorable. And you couldn't just rely on image.
Right.
In fact, a lot of the bands that you and I probably listen to, particularly the British groups, I mean, I can't name you all the members of the Kinks, and I can't name you all the members of the Yardbirds, but I can name you a lot of their songs.
Yeah.
And in those days, it was the song that was important, not really the person singing it. It wasn't the singer, it was the song.
That's a
great
point.
Now it's not the song, it's the singer. And
the
so-called singer, I should say.
Yeah, that's. I really appreciate that, because also you were talking about the Beatles evolving into the studio, because they were on tour and they weren't enjoying themselves. They didn't think people were really enjoying their music. It was more of like this big experience, this big party. But that's where they decided, you know, let's stop that and let's go into the studio and really see what we got. You know, let's see what we can do. And I think that kind of turned things, because, you know, you can look at, like, one band I always look at are the Moody Blues, who kind of, I listen to their music and I think, man, that's incredible. How did they ever do that on stage? I've never heard them live, but to do what they did in the studio. And I think that was one thing that I see in the music of Klaatu, is the fact that, you know, although it came out later than the Beatles and all that, you can get that feeling that there was this effort, this intellectual effort, this let's push it, let's just don't, you know, keep up with what's going on, but let's push the envelope a little bit. And that's what totally, you know, impressed me about your writing, your songwriting, about the band. If you could talk a little bit about, you know, you'd said when you first met Dee and then Terry came in. What do you think it was, John, that made you guys click? And what was the chemistry there? Because you can get a lot of really talented people. And I've been around music all my life. And I've known sometimes when you get musicians together, people that are very talented, it doesn't always work out real well, because you can get one person that's going one way, get another person going another way, and their ideas maybe clash a little bit. What do you think was the key there? Was what made it all work?
Well, when Klaatu started out, our very first recording was recorded on January 1st, 1973, New Year's Day. And it was just me and Dee, and it remained me and Dee for about a year and a half. And the reason why Dee and I got along, I think, was that we were both competent songwriters in our own right, but we had different styles. And we never actually collaborated together on songwriting. The closest we came to that was I wrote the lyrics for Sir Army Shoot by listening to our first single backwards. I played Heinous of Uranus backwards on my 420 Continental Phillips. And I had heard the story about Lennon hearing Rain backwards and wanting the vocal to be put on in the ending there. And I thought, geez, I wonder what it's going to sound like if I listen to this backwards. So I just started listening to it. And as I'm listening to this gobbledygook, I'm hearing words, you know, that aren't really there. You know what I mean? Like phonetically. So I started jotting them down. And the original title of that was Suna Sunaru, which is Anus Uranus backwards. And I took I used to type my lyrics because my handwriting is terrible. Actually, you know what? Believe it or not, John Lennon used to type lyrics. Can you believe that?
Well, for awesome.
Me when I learned it. But at any rate, I took some lyrics to the studio the next session we had, and showed them to Terry Brown and Dee Long, and I said, this is what I heard when I listened to Anus backwards, you know, and they said, oh wow, that's neat. So they listened to it, and they could hear the words as well that I'd done. So that was in 1973. We actually didn't record, or you know, Sir Army Suit wasn't actually recorded until what's the name of the song? Dee's backwards song there. I think it's Sir Army Suit. No, it's the album. Silly Boys. So
right.
the lyrics in Silly Boys are actually the Heinous of Uranus lyrics backwards, and that was recorded in 1977-78. So we waited like almost 5 years before we actually used the idea. But it was something that was just a spur of the moment thing, you know, where I just put it on for a lark, and I wasn't expecting to be able to hear a whole song's worth of lyrics on there. I might have to try that again sometime.
That's pretty awesome. I mean, it had to feel good to do that, and to be able to just say, you know, this is something. I mean, it's like going out, you know, and something that's brand new, and you're hearing things, and you're thinking. It's like stimulating. You know, intellectually. And I think that's so cool, because a lot of the music, and you kind of touched on it a little bit, John, about, you know, it's all about the stage performance and the persona. But to me, I listen to the music and I'm thinking, okay, it's like, I want a little more, you know, I want something a little deeper than that. And let's take a music break here in a minute. My guest is John Walashuk. And if you want to know more about the band Klaatu, you can go on their official website, which is Klaatu.org. And if you'd like to ask John a question, you can call 877-694-5613. I think there's a little something you can hit that makes a question mark pop up here that I could see it, and we'll bring you on and you can ask John a question. But we are talking about, you know, I love talking about that era of music in the 60s and then going into the 70s. Now, when you guys were recording the first album and you were working with Terry and you were putting it together, what was it like the rest of the music horizon, what the other people that were out there making music? There were so many things going on in the 70s with Southern rock and with, like we talked about, the Beach Boys were starting to experiment into different types of things. Then you had, different bands were just popping up, and metal music was happening, and then disco music was about to happen, and there were so many things that were going on. What were you guys, your mindset to think, okay, we're going to stay, this is where we're going to be? You know what I mean? Because I'm sure that, you know, from what I've read and talking to some of the other members of the group, that there were a lot of people pulling, like the record industries, the record companies are always saying, sound like this, do this, you know, be more popular, do these type of things. What was it, John, that made you guys just true to your sound and what you wanted it to be?
Well, I think it was really the opportunity that Terry Brown gave us, because he was sort of, you know, we were recording in his studio, and he was sort of, we were almost like his hobby. So, I mean, we had a very, very close relationship. In fact, even closer than producer and artist. It was, you know, he was really, we really thought of him as a member of the band, and he was 100% behind us. I mean, and so we didn't really have any financial pressure. And we didn't have a record company telling us what to do at that point, because at that point we were simply signed to Terry's independent production company. And we had access to Doug Riley's arrangements when we needed them. And it was just, you know, we didn't have to concern ourselves with what was happening outside. We were kind of protected by the umbrella that Terry Brown had you know, sort of put over us. And that's what he wanted. He did not want us thinking about those things. He wanted us to think only about our music. And you got to give him a lot of credit for that, because there's not too many producers that would have taken that tack, especially on his own dime. But he did, and we owe him a lot. If it wasn't for Terry Brown, there would not have been Klaatu, I guarantee you.
Now, we started the show off, John, with Dr. Marvello. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that came into life?
Dr. Marvello?
Yeah, Dr. Marvello.
Dr. Marvello was actually written, I think, in 1972, prior to Klaatu. And we actually performed it in Mudcow, which is the band that Dee and I and Terry Draper were in prior to Klaatu. And when it came time to do a second single, because in the beginning, when I first started working, Dee and I first started working with Terry Brown, we weren't thinking in terms of an album. We were thinking in terms of singles.
Yep.
Because the distributor at the time, GRT Records, was only interested in singles at the outset. So we were doing our second single, and Dee had come up with a great little tune called For You Girl, which is sort of a Gilbert O'Sullivan thing. And I put forward Dr. Marvello. So that's how that one got going. It had an interesting evolution, though, during its recording stage, because I didn't really have the full concept of what I wanted to do with it. The bed track was actually me on grand piano, Dee on a Moog bass, and a drummer named Whitey Glenn, who was a session drummer here in Toronto. And that was the bed track. And of the bed track, the only thing that survived was the drums and the Moog bass line. The grand piano got dumped in favor of a Fender Rhodes, which was put through an instant phaser. And that's partly where we get, you know, that was the first step on the road to weirdness on that track. And then we sort of compounded that with I had a 12-string acoustic guitar that I borrowed that was playing sort of like pizzicato type parts with it, and then we borrowed an electric sitar from the guitar player in Doug Riley's band and threw that on there, and of course the Mellotron.
Yeah.
And the Mellotron, that was the very first time I'd ever touched a Mellotron. And we borrowed it from another studio downtown. And I remember having to pick it up. We had it for 24 hours. I went down and picked it up. And Terry Brown made a vacant back office at the studio available to me. So I took the Mellotron in there along with my little Philips Continental 420, played back a monitor mix of Marvello and started composing parts, because we had to record them that night. So I wrote the entire Mellotron part that day. And of course, the very first thing I did when I turned it on was to play the opening to Strawberry Fields Forever. I mean, you just have to do that, right? I mean, no musician worth his salt wouldn't do that. So I tried that. And once I got over that, and then made a couple of Moody Blues tunes, you know, because the Moody Blues actually were quite avid users of Mellotron. They really, really had great use of that. But anyway, so that's the Mellotron really was a real turning point, because it really, all of a sudden, it really was psychedelic. It started to sound very surreal. And, you know, I put some backwards piano on there after that, and some weird percussion. And, you know, we just tried to make it as surreal as we could. And the bass is a Hofner violin bass, by the way. And, of course, I was quite influenced by McCartney's bass playing. I think it's pretty obvious. You know, that track just sort of evolved. I actually have a series of monitor mixes of it that start from the very first bed track, which
wow.
was really awful. But it, you know, progressively gets more stuff added to it, and then, you know, you can see the evolution of the tune.
I was just wondering, what's it like when you're listening to a song that, you know, you've written and that you're working on, and you're listening to it, John, and you're thinking, wow, this is something. You know you're hitting the ball out of the park. That's got to just be a great feeling.
It is. It's a rare feeling, but it's a great one.
It's just got to feel so good to hear that, you know, to hear it over
yeah.
the headphones and think, you know, this is pretty cool.
Because
me included, the listeners will probably never know that, but it's got to be such a great thing. And then to like look over, you know, at Terry or Dee or somebody and just think, yeah, this is pretty cool. Got to feel great.
Yeah, we had a few of those moments, I must admit, and they do feel very, very good. I mean, you really feel exhilarated because, in actual fact, it feels like you've accomplished something that was way above what your capability was in the first place. You know, you sort of reached up really high and you snatched a gift from the air here. And, but as I say, it doesn't happen all the time. But it's, on the first album, we had more than our fair share of those types of moments. On the first album, largely because it was recorded over a period of almost 3 years on a sporadic basis. We would have breaks between sessions that lasted as long as 3 weeks, 4 weeks, something like that. The other thing, too, that helped out, or at least didn't hurt, was that I was actually an employee. I finally did get a job, by the way, at Toronto Sound Studios. I started working as a tape op in September of 74. And I continued working there until June of 76 when we started working on the Hope album, and Terry Brown decided that we had to go on full salary as musicians. So I stopped working at the studio and went full time in class because we only had 8 months to deliver the Hope album.
Yeah, and that's another show in itself. But, I mean, was it different from that point on to know that now you had a time frame, you had a deadline, you had expectations? Was it different to approach the Hope album, John, from 347?
Well, we didn't want to lower our standards or anything, so we still were shooting pretty high, and we also decided that we wanted, at least Terry Draper and I talked about wanting to do a concept album. And so, you know, we really bit off a big piece there, and we worked really, really hard from June through almost to the next May, because the original deadline for delivery of that album was February of 77. But then the rumor hit, the Beatles rumor hit, and Capitol put back the release date by 6 months. So we ended up getting some extra time to work on the Hope album that we weren't expecting. But
right.
In fact, at that point, we are actually working in two shifts. Terry Brown and I would work the days and D. Long and Terry Draper would work the evenings, just so that we had, you know, round the clock work, so we could get this thing done.
Wow. Well, we do have a caller. Let's take a call here. 1 second.
John, can you hear me?
Do you have a question for John?
Yeah. Good talking to you. John and I. No, in 1977, you had a single calling Occupants, and I was just wondering your thoughts on the Carpenters, what they did with it, because not only did they make their own, you know, their own version of the song, but it was within months of when your song was on track to become a hit, and then theirs went on to become a top 40. And I want to know if their people contacted you and you gave them your endorsement to go ahead and record it.
No, that's not quite how it worked. I think they had already recorded it by the time we got wind of it, but they didn't really need to ask permission from us, I don't think. They needed to get permission from the publisher, which was ATV Music in those days. But they didn't actually need to get permission from us to do it. Although we probably would have been happy to give it to them anyway, because they were a top 10 act and had been since 1970. It never hurts to have a top 10 act do a cover version of one of your tunes, especially when you've never had one before.
What are your thoughts on what they did with the song?
Well, I love Karen's voice, and I must confess that the very first time I heard it, we were actually sent demonstration records. We were sent 3 demonstration records that were autographed by the Carpenters, and I remember listening to it for the very first time, and the thing that really impacted me the most was hearing Karen Carpenter utter our lyrics in that gorgeous voice of hers. And there were some really nice harmony parts that they did. But the thing that I was probably as pleased about, if not more, was that they really didn't screw around with our arrangement. You know, they didn't change the chords or the, you know, anything like that. They were fairly faithful in reproducing the intent that we had on the tune. There was a couple of things that slightly differently, but you know, all in all, they didn't remake it. Let's put it that way.
Well, I want to thank you very much, John, because you definitely gave my brother and I some excitement. And back in March of '77, when we bought your album, we were all trying to analyze it, trying to figure out whether or not it was the Beatles. So I got to tell you that. And I mean, we were analyzing it in detail.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, thank you very much. I appreciate your interest.
Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for the call. That was a great question. I've also thought, you know, John, that if you take just a few minutes, and I want to play a song here in a minute, but with, you know, that that article that came out from, I think it was Steve Smith from the Providence, about, you know, could this be the Beatles? And one of the things I think is amazing about it, how many bands could be compared to that? I mean, you have to be pretty darn good, you know what I mean, to people to think that. And I know that, you know, you want to stand on your own 2 feet as musicians, and you want to know this is our music. But also, it's like comparing you with that. Did you find that as a compliment at all?
Oh, sure. I mean, I'm probably the biggest Beatles fan in the world, maybe not the biggest, but in the top 10. And so to have us being compared to our idols, you know, even though we weren't consciously trying to strive for that, but to, you know, I've always maintained that, you know, if the music was crap, nobody would be thinking that you were the Beatles. But you have to have a certain level of quality in the music before anyone's going to think that you might be the Beatles. So from that point of view, it was complimentary. It was pretty damaging in the long run, though, to our career. But that was just, you know, one of those things. But we wanted our music to speak for itself, so we were largely, you know, remaining anonymous. And I think if it wasn't that, that probably was the thing that maybe made it possible that there was no names associated with the music and people who only had the music alone to listen to. And they reached some wrong conclusions, but again, because they were comparing us to what I think is the best, sure, you'd have to be an idiot not to be complimented by that.
I think that's a great point. Well, one song I'd like to play, and if you could talk a little bit about Sub Rosa Subway, and I just love this song, and I would like your input on it before we play it, just to talk about its birth and where it came from a little bit before we play it.
Sure. Well, Sub Rosa Subway, the idea for that song actually came from an advertisement. I think it was Dow Chemical that had an advertisement in the Scientific American magazine back in 1970. And I happened to see it in the magazine, and I tore out, took it home because I thought it was a great idea for a song. And I actually wrote the original version of Sub Rosa Subway back in September 1970. But it didn't really resurface until we signed with Terry Brown, and then all of a sudden I needed a blockbuster tune to be my first single. So I pulled out Sub Rosa Subway, and Dino and I revamped it somewhat, and we made a demo of it, took it to the studio, played it to Terry Brown. He said, yeah, it's great, but you know what? It's not quite there yet. So we had to go back and revamp it again. And that second revamping is where we came up with the middle section, the bridge. And then we did a demo of that, showed it to him. He said, yeah, you got it now. So we did it. And it really started sounding great from the bass. There was one of those magical tracks that fortunately it sounded great from the bed track up. And the bed track was me on grand piano, Whitey Glenn on drums, and D. Long on electric guitar. It was his Gibson 335, which he played through a little transistor radio, by the way.
Wow.
But after that first session, there was magic in it already. And then by the time we finished putting sweetening on it and everything, it really got to be, quite an elaborate track. And my fondest memory of the whole thing was when we overdubbed the strings and trumpets in March of 73. And I wasn't quite 23 years old. And I got to sit in the studio watching this large string section play on this track as they were recording it, and they were getting a buzz off playing it. It was amazing. You could hear, normally between takes, musicians are talking about their wives or what they're going to do with their kids on the weekend, and what about that golf date we had last year, but this was not the case on this session. They were buzzing. They wanted to do another take after take after take. They just
That's
really
awesome.
Got off on it. And so I was all smiles that day, I can tell you.
Well, let's play this, and then we'll come back, and my guest is John Rolishuk, and we'll be right back after this, and we'll complete the interview with John. It's just been great talking to you, but let's play. This is Sub Rosa Subway, and we'll be right back.
Back in 1870, just beneath the great white way, Alfred Beach worked secretly, a risking all to write a dream. We'll be right back.
John, I would like to thank you so much for being on the show tonight. It's just been great talking to you, and I really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, and I hope I meet with your listeners' approval and expectations.
Well, is there anything you'd like to say? We just have a couple minutes left, John, to the fans out there. I know there's a big fan base of Klaatu. It seems to just grow. I think that more people hear the music. I think it's amazing. Is there anything you would like to say to the people out there, you know, before we finish up the interview?
Well, I'd just like to thank them all for being so loyal and their interest in our music. I mean, the first album's 40th anniversary is not far off. I think it's August the 6th when it was released 40 years ago. And I really never in my wildest dreams did I ever anticipate that our music would still be being appreciated 40 years after we started recording it. So it all boils down to the fans. You know, without the fans, there really isn't anything. And I can't tell you how much we all appreciate their support.
Well, we appreciate the music, and thank you so much, John, for being on the show tonight. And for the fans out there, this live broadcast will be podcast in podcast form probably about 5 minutes after tonight's show is over. And thank you so much, John. We really appreciate it, and we'd love to have you back on. I know there's so much more we could talk about.
My pleasure, John. I'd be happy to talk to you anytime.
Thank you so much, and I want to thank the people out there that support John Talk Radio, and we'll talk to everybody next week. And thank you, John, and we'll talk to everyone later.
Great.
transmits thought energy far beyond the norm. You close your eyes, you concentrate together.